This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Richard Lavoie is a veteran educator whose interests include motivation. He's interested in motivating kids who are struggling in school. Why did they struggle? What can adults do to inspire success? Richard Lavoie is our guest in this portion of the program. He is the author most recently of The Motivation Breakthrough, Six Secrets to Turning on the Tuned Out Child. We've all probably heard these sentences, whether applied to us when we were kids or to kids we knew or our children. If she would just put her mind to it, he doesn't seem to care. She's not trying. He's lazy. Lavoie says we need to step out of that box and rethink these kinds of assumptions. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls for our guest, Richard Lavoie. You can join us with your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Richard Lavoie worked as a teacher, then headmaster at residential special education facilities for more than 30 years. He is now a lecturer and consultant on learning disability issues. His first book was It's So Much Work to Be Your Friend, Helping the Child with Learning Disabilities Find Social Success. He's also produced some videos, including How Difficult Can This Be? And First One Picked On. His new book, The Motivation Breakthrough, Six Secrets to Turning on the Tuned Out Child, is published by Touchstone Books. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Lavoie, welcome back to the program. Good to talk with you again.
Well, I'm delighted to be back. I had a terrific time last time.
Good. Okay. Well, you know, you begin this book with a couple of stories that I think are really good stories to begin with about two young people, Megan and Daniel. Mm-hmm. And the stories are a good introduction to the subject of motivating children because, in big part, they illustrate the importance of an environment with caring people.
Right.
Would you tell us about Megan and Daniel and what allows them to thrive? What motivates them?
Well, the two stories at the beginning are really intended as fables, I guess, although they're absolutely true, and they happen to people in my own life. Our daughter, Megan, struggled mightily in school in third grade and had a particularly disastrous year in fourth grade, frankly, at the hands of a teacher who simply didn't get it and wasn't willing to make any sort of accommodations and modifications to meet some needs that she had. And then she entered the fifth grade and came under the tutelage of this absolutely magical teacher who just turned things around by doing very, very small things, but understanding. I think in the book I tell the story of the end of the first week of school, Megan coming downstairs and delighted because the teacher had put a note inside her book when she opened a workbook that night that told her what a good week Megan had had, and we look forward to having a good year together. And those sort of very small things sort of turned Megan around. So I tell that story basically to remind teachers and parents that, you know, just like in the fairy tales, one adult can change the life of a child. And then the second story is about our nephew Daniel, who was really labeled as being unmotivated by his teachers his whole career in school, but when he found what he was interested in, which happened to be flying, he just absolutely, literally, and figuratively took off and got his pilot's license a week after he was 16 years old. Now, that's something that I could never do in my wildest dreams, and yet he was able to accomplish it at a very young age. And the point there was that he had always been told by his teachers and his parents were told that this kid is impossible to motivate, when actually it's just that the child, that he wasn't getting what he needed from school and found it someplace else. You know, there's a lot of work, as you well know, in our urban areas about gangs, and gangs are really sort of a plague on our communities now. But what people are beginning to realize is we need to get rid of the gangs, certainly to cut down on the violence, but we also need to look at what the gangs are giving the kids that they're not getting from school. Or from home. They're getting total acceptance. They're getting ability to use whatever skill areas they have. And certainly the gangs are a scourge on our society, but we also need to recognize that obviously they are giving something to the kids that we're not giving to them at home and at school.
Yeah. Back to the story of Daniel. I'm wondering if anybody at school found the key that unlocked Daniel's door, so to speak.
They did eventually at the end. I think that, and he did end up graduating high school and now is actually in college and doing quite well. They did at the end, but what they did with Daniel, and if in the first section of the book, what I did is tried to explode an awful lot of myths about the way we motivate kids. And what they did with Daniel is the things that we always do with kids to motivate them. We punish them, or we give them rewards, or we have them compete against other kids. Those are the three techniques we tend to use, and none of them are effective, although we continue to use them with kids who struggle. In terms of competition, what the research shows very clearly is that the only person motivated by competition is a person who thinks they have the chance of winning. So if you're a fourth grade teacher and decide to teach spelling by using spelling bees contests and quizzes and games, the only kid you're motivating is the good speller. And so competition doesn't work, reward systems don't work, punishment doesn't work. What does work is finding what motivates the child, what specifically motivates the child, and what his motivational style is, and then working a system that meets that style.
Yeah. You quote FDR early in the book as saying, do something, if it works, do more of it, if it doesn't, do something else.
Exactly.
So why are we slow, reluctant, resistant to do something else?
It's a great puzzlement to me, frankly, because there are other solutions out there. Much of the work that, much of the basis for my book is based on Maslow's work, which was, you know, published the middle of last century. The work is available there, but we continue to just try the same old thing. And what we do as teachers, and I am a teacher, I'm married to a teacher, my five best friends are teachers, I love teachers, but what we tend to do as teachers is we can't make the curriculum exciting enough to motivate the child. We can't make the War of 1812 exciting enough to motivate the child. So what we do is say to the child, I know this stuff is boring and I know it's something you're not interested in, but if you don't learn it, you're not going to pass the test. So we take the test and we use that to motivate him extrinsically rather than trying to motivate him intrinsically and get the motivation to come from inside. And, you know, in researching the book, I looked at the research that was done in education on student motivation. Frankly, it wasn't very good. I looked at the psychological research that was done, and it wasn't very good, but I found a treasure chest of impeccably done research on what motivates kids in what seems to be an unlikely source, although if you think about it, it's actually quite a likely source, and that is Madison Avenue, that the advertising industry has spent literally hundreds of millions of dollars researching how to motivate the 9-year-old girl in California versus the 11-year-old boy in New York. So that research is beautifully done, although, you know, I think we would all admit it's been misused in order to sell kids the things they don't need. But the reality is the research is beautifully done. And so what I did is took that research and translated it for teachers. You know, for years, advertisers and toy makers have known that, for instance, fourth-grade boys love to collect things. They don't care if they're any good. They just love to collect them. So companies came out with Pokemon cards and baseball cards for generations because they know the fourth or fifth grade boy loves collecting things. Well, teachers ought to know that too. And so build your fourth grade curriculum around the kid collecting things. You know, make that the basis of your curriculum. So we kind of took this research, again, that was beautifully done, although perhaps misused by Madison Avenue, and translated it for teachers and for parents. And we're getting really very, very, very good feedback on it. The book is only, as you said in the kind introduction, the book has only been out a month or so, but it's based on a workshop that I've been doing for about 10 years. And so we've got some really good feedback on the effectiveness of the approach.
Yeah. Well, maybe we could walk through this a little bit in terms of, let's go back to the War of 1812. What do you think Madison Avenue would do with the War of 1812?
Well, again, what they realize is there's a thing in advertising called fusion. And it basically, the best example, and I will get to the War of 1812 to show you how it works, but the best example is the Pokemon cards that came out. There were those things, they literally made almost $1 billion selling Pokemon cards. But before they put the Pokemon cards out, they did $10 million worth of research. And they found that there are three things that a boy needs at the age of fourth or fifth grade. They need power, they need belonging, and they need freedom. Now, these cards gave them great power because mom and dad had no idea what the Pokemon cards were. Older brothers and sisters had no idea what they were. So it gave the kid a real sense of power that he had this information no one else had. Belonging was a second need, and it gave him a real sense of the whole point of the Pokemon cards was to trade cards with other kids. So it gave them a sense of belonging to this group. And thirdly, freedom kids at that age love a degree of freedom. And I remember our son was collecting Pokemon cards at the time, and I remember him saying to me one time he was going to trade one card. He was going to trade 25 cards to this kid to get one card back. Now, I didn't understand Pokemon, so I said, fine, go ahead, be your cards. If you think that's a good deal, go ahead, even though you're giving up 25 for one. So it gave him a tremendous amount of freedom to make some decisions. And that's what we need to do when you're teaching the War of 1812, realize that there are some kids in that class who are going to be motivated by working on a long-term project about the War of 1812. Other kids are going to be more motivated by doing an independent study about the War of 1812. Some kids are going to want to do, want to show what they know by putting together a diorama showing some of the battles. Others will want to do a computer search on the battles. And so really looking at what turns this kid on, what motivates this kid, and planning individually. It's motivation is the only thing in education we still try to use one size fits all. We recognize if you're a fourth grade teacher, you recognize you're going to have to use five or six different reading approaches, five or six different writing approaches in order to teach the kids how to read and write, and yet we think we can get away with just using one motivational approach, and that's some chart on the wall or a star chart or some reward system, and it's simply not working. National Education Association did a survey last year, and America's teachers said that they would describe 25% of the kids in their classes as being unmotivated and disengaged. That's a quarter of our kids. That's an awful lot of kids.
Yeah. Now, what, and I know you've heard this from teachers. A teacher, you know, says, motivate, schmotivate. That's not my job.
Yep.
And I've got 22 kids in this classroom.
Yep.
And we're here to learn, and we've got to have some things, you know.
Yeah. And though you're absolutely right, Celeste, those are the two arguments I hear all the time. And let me address both of them if I could. The first one, it's not my job. It clearly is. I mean, any learning theory that you study, from Lovaas in the last century to Gardner, who's the big learning theorist now, any learning theory you study begins with motivation. It is indeed your job to motivate, just like it's a salesman's job to motivate. I mean, if a salesman went into his office, a gentleman selling, you know, lawnmowers at Sears went into his boss and said, I didn't sell any lawnmowers today because the customers weren't motivated. The sales manager would say, well, you know, that's your job. You know, it's your job to motivate customers. You just can't stand there and wait till people come to you. And it's the same in education. I remember a teacher saying to me one time, Rick, I taught it to him, but he didn't learn it. And I said, well, that's an interesting concept. That's like a salesman saying to his boss, I sold it to him, but he didn't buy it. I mean, if the person didn't buy it, you didn't sell it. If the kid didn't learn it, you didn't teach it. So I feel very strongly, and the research would back me up on this, that it is the teacher's job to motivate the kids. And it's, again, using the refrigerator analogy, the lawnmower analogy. If my refrigerator blew up this afternoon, I would go to the local appliance store to buy a refrigerator, and you know, Celeste, I'd be a very easy sell. It wouldn't take a great salesman to sell me a refrigerator. My refrigerator's not working, and I need one. The good salesman is someone who could sell a refrigerator to somebody who is not sure he wants one and not sure what kind he ought to get. So I think teachers sometimes say, I'm a good motivator because I've got 10 kids in the front of my class who are always raising their hands and volunteering. My bias is the test of a real motivator is what are you doing with the kid in the back of the room with his head on the desk. That's the kid that you need to motivate. So in answer to the first complaint, I think it truly is the teacher's job to motivate. And again, that's not just my opinion. As I said, any learning theory begins with motivation. And the second argument, I've got 22, 25 kids in my class, very valid argument. And so that's what we did in the book is we took, there were basically 8 or 10 different kinds of profiles that kids can have in terms of motivation, but we brought it down to a very manageable 6 P's that are in the book that if you use, some kids respond well to praise, some to prestige, some to prizes, some to projects, some to people, and some to power. And if you just sort of mix up your motivational approaches and use all of those 6 at some given time during the term, you're going to be hitting all your kids. I mean, I spent 35 years walking the halls of schools, and I know the incredible pressure the teachers are under, and I would never say that you need to come up with 25 different unique ways to motivate your 25 kids, but I think it is realistic to say try these 6 approaches and you're going to pretty much reach all your kids.
Yeah, so in the lesson plan, you take a look at your lesson plan and you think, how can I get these motivational approaches into the plan.
Exactly. And you know what? In fact, I was out in your area just a month or so ago speaking, and what I told the audience there, and I tell audiences everywhere, is that what we tend to do as teachers, I know I did it when I was teaching, is we tend to motivate kids by what motivates us. So, for instance, one of the things that motivates me is autonomy. I love working by myself on a project. You know, give me a problem, put me in my office, close the door, I'll change the world. You know, I love working by myself. I'm not a real committee guy. Now, suppose you're in my class, you're a student in my class, and you're motivated by one of the other motivators, which is gregariousness. You love working with other people. So me as a teacher, I decide I want to motivate you. You've done a nice job. I want to reward Celeste in some way. So what I do is say, guess what? I'm going to let you, Celeste, go down to the library all by yourself for the rest of the afternoon and work on this project because I'd love that. But I don't have the perspective that it's probably the last thing you'd want to do. You'd feel, you know, if you could bring your posse with you, that'd be fine. But yeah, to go there in yourself is the last thing you want to do. And I love doing this with teachers because you can see the kind of the lights go on and they say, yeah, that's what I do. I take the one thing that motivates me and I try to use that to motivate all the kids. And there's no reason to think that these 25 very unique kids sitting in front of you are going to be motivated by exactly what you're motivated by.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, educator Richard Lavoie. He's the author most recently of The Motivation Breakthrough, Six Secrets to Turning on the Tuned Out Child. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. We look forward to your questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, let's talk a little bit about these styles. You mentioned autonomy and gregariousness. There's some other kinds of motivational forces or styles, maybe. Yep. There's a good word as well. Status, inquisitiveness, aggression, power, yep, recognition, and affiliation.
Right. Right. Those are all different, and the thing is, we're each motivated to a degree by each of those. You have some status needs. You have some autonomy needs. You as an individual have some aggressive needs. But there generally tend to be two or three of those needs that really rise above the others. When I do this with an audience, I had an audience of 1,500 people the other day, and I ran over this list. And as I ran over the list, I gave my own profile. You know, I'm not particularly motivated by power, very motivated by autonomy, and very motivated by inquisitiveness. And as I explained, I gave my profile, and I asked the audience to kind of keep track of their profiles, their individual profiles as we went through. When we got done, I said, please raise your hand if your profile was identical to mine, and not a single hand went up. In other words, there were 1,500 people in that room, and no one's profile was exactly like mine, and I would dare say nobody's profile was exactly like nearly anybody else is in that room. We probably had 1,300 different profiles for the 1,500 people who were there. And it just shows how dynamic this really is. You know, the business world for years tried to motivate employees by employee of the month, employee of the year. Remember when that was a big deal, mm-hmm, a few years ago? And they found there were some employees who would run over their grandmother to win that award. There were others who couldn't care less, and there were still others who were very resentful of it, and it really backfired on them. So anytime you try to motivate everyone in a group by using one approach, you're going to turn some people off. And like I said, what we tend to do as teachers and as parents is try to motivate the kid by using our primary motivator. I'm also very motivated by affiliation. That means I love being identified with something larger than me. Every ball cap I own, every jacket I own is a Red Sox cap or a Bruins jacket. I love walking through an airport in Chicago and have people say, gee, that guy must be from Boston. I love being identified with something larger than me. So when I was a teacher many times, when I was teaching, the first thing I'd do is make T-shirts with the class name on it and give them out to the kids, and I'd order seven for myself. What I found was there were some kids who'd wear them until they fell off their backs. Other kids never wore them again. I mean, why would a kid motivated by power care about having a T-shirt with somebody else's name on it? So, you know, again, I was doing what we tend to do as teachers, which is take the thing that motivates me and try to use that to motivate the other kids.
Yeah. Well, how do we begin to learn what My microphone is acting up here on me for a moment here. All right, we're back to normal. How do we discover what drives our children?
What we did in the book is to put together a very simple, it only takes, I think it probably takes 3 or 4 minutes to administer to a child, a very simple survey that you give the kid that basically says, you know, if you found $50, what would you want as a reward? To have your picture in the newspaper? If, now, a kid who's very turned on by achievement would like to have his picture in the newspaper. A kid who's turned on by gregariousness would like to make sure you told all of his friends that he returned the money that he found. So it basically says, if you found $50, what would you like to do? And it lists 3 or 4 things to be that could be given as rewards. And when you boil all that down, and again, it takes a, it's not a scientific survey at all. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of a quick down and dirty survey you can do with the kids. And at the end, you get a pretty good idea of what motivates this kid. And it really does come from the horse's mouth because you're asking the child to help you fill out the form. And then you begin to get an idea of things that motivate kids. And that's what you try to use is, again, use those techniques, use the prizes, the projects, you know, even praise. I'm sitting right in front of me. I've got a cover story from New York Magazine that was out last February. The headline is "Praise is Dangerous." I mean, even praise that we all agreed you should praise kids. Even that's coming into some question now. That if you're constantly praising kids in order to motivate them, it eventually becomes white noise after a while. They really don't hear it. And in the book, there's a whole chapter on praise about how to give praise effectively. Because just saying, gee, you're wonderful, again, after a while, the child stops hearing that, and it doesn't mean a great deal to them. And so you have to get creative even about doing something that seems to be as uncontroversial as praise.
Yeah. Well, nobody is great 24/7, 365.
Yeah. And, of course, we all like to think our kids are. And, you know, one of the small hints in the book that any parent or teacher can use, we found it more effective rather than praising the child to praise what he did. Rather, in other words, the child does a great job of cleaning his room and saying, instead of saying, Timmy, you're wonderful, saying, Tim, the room looks great. It looks just terrific. And actually praise the job rather than praise the child and mix that up once in a while and come up with creative ways to give praise. I encourage teachers, you know, if Billy's done a real nice, really, really worked hard on a science project, to mention it to the principal. So the next time principal sees Billy, he says, hey, Billy, I heard you're going to do a great job in science. Well, for a kid who's turned on by status, for a kid who's turned on by gregariousness, and that's a huge thing for him to have the principal mention that to him. So we need to get pretty creative about the way we try to encourage kids. You know, I think somebody asked me one time in an interview, if I could tell the American people one thing about kids, what would it be? And I deal with kids who struggle in school. And what I came up with was, I think we need to come to the profound understanding that kids go to school for a living. That's their job. They do it 6 hours a day. Not only is it their job, it's their entire identity. If you run into somebody, an 11-year-old kid in your neighborhood, Celeste, you know, the first thing you say to him is, hi, Billy, how's school?
Yeah.
You know, it's their entire identity. And now you might be with his dad for 2 hours before you'd think to ask his dad how things are at work. In our culture, we don't identify adults with what they do for a living, but we clearly identify kids with what they do for a living. And so kids who are struggling in school, it's not just a matter of they're not doing well those 4, 5, 6 hours a day. It really impacts their entire identity. It's their job. It'd be like if you had a job 6 hours a day where you were failing at everything you did, you'd begin to develop emotional problems as well.
That brings me back to thinking about your daughter, Megan. That was a horrible year for her.
It was very difficult to write that because it was a very emotional thing for me. I mean, my wife and I are both educators. We got several educational degrees between us, and we just couldn't fix it. We tried and tried to pile the praise on and the reinforcement and encouragement at home, and we just could not offset the 6 hours of negativity that she was getting. It was a difficult year for all of us. And the teacher, you know, probably would have been a good teacher with some kids. She just didn't seem to understand Meg or really care to. And Megan had that awful feeling that the primary adult in her life didn't like her very much, and that's a pretty tough feeling for a 10-year-old to have. But again, the reason I tell that story is not so much that end of it, but the other end where this magical teacher walked in and just changed it. And I think sometimes we think a kid is, you know, frankly so far gone at 15, 16, 17 years old that you can never turn it around. And that's the reason for the other story, Dan, nephew Dan, who had failed so miserably in school for so long. Once he found out his, once somebody found the key, you know, he's, like I said, literally and figuratively took off and is doing extraordinarily well for himself.
Yeah. There's another story maybe you would share with us this afternoon, and it's a heartbreaker. The child who endured a beating rather than endure the humiliation of reading in front of the classroom.
Yeah, that is a tough one, and it was about a young man who came up to me after a speaking engagement one time and told me the story that he came from a very violent family, his father was particularly violent with him, particularly when he made a mistake or did something wrong, although I don't think the dad really needed an excuse to be violent with him. And he was so embarrassed, this little boy was so embarrassed in the first grade, he told me the story when he was 23 or 24, and he actually shook when he told me. He was so embarrassed that he could not read in the first grade, and he's just unable to. And the way they taught reading in the school district is that the reading specialist would come every other Thursday and make the kids who couldn't read come to the front of class and read out loud in front of the others, which is draconian on the face of it anyway, but that's the way she did it. And it was so embarrassing for him to have to do that, that every other Thursday for the entire year, he would go into the boys' room just before the reading specialist came, and he'd break his glasses on purpose. And he did that so he wouldn't have to read in front of the other kids. But he did it with the full knowledge that when he got home, his father was going to beat him. And I use that as an example because I'm sure that reading teacher wrote someplace in his kid's records, this kid is not motivated, because he must have known he was doing it on purpose. I would submit to you that's probably the most motivated child she will ever have in her career. He was so motivated to avoid being embarrassed that he was willing to take a beating from his dad twice a month. And that's what the whole point of the book is, that all human behavior is motivated. If you right now hang up and end this interview, I can't say, well, Celeste wasn't motivated. You were motivated to end the interview. That was your motivation. And so when a kid sits in the back of the room with his head on the desk, don't tell me he's not motivated. He's motivated to sit there with his head on the desk. And I think that's the most profound understanding we can have about motivation, is that all human behavior is motivated. And again, this boy was so motivated to avoid being embarrassed, he was willing to take a beating twice a month. That's pretty significant motivation, I think.
Yeah. And just think what the long-term consequences could be for a kid like that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a, you know, I have a blessing and a burden of traveling around the country on a regular basis and talking to people and hearing stories, and there is a world of hurt out there. I mean, we know so much. My problem is, and again, I've been an educator my whole career, and I love the field. I couldn't imagine doing anything else. But we know so much more about kids who struggle. Our information base about these kids has increased exponentially. Russ Barkley, who's one of the foremost experts on attention deficits, said recently that he believes that 90% of what we know about ADD we've learned in the last 5 years. We know so much more about the way these kids function, but our methodology hasn't caught up. So we're still using kind of the same old techniques, even though we know so much more about the way these kids function. So we need to, we've done so much to research understanding why they act the way they do. Now we've got to invest as much time and energy in coming up with techniques that reflect this research.
Hmm. Let's talk with a listener now, a caller in Champaign, line one. Hi, you're on the air with Richard Lavoie. We've got a problem here. Hold on. I don't know what the situation is. We have some gremlins in the system today. Let's try one more time here. Listener on in Champaign on line one. Boy, we can't.
Yeah, I can't hear that at all.
I can just hear him way, way, way down. And I know that there were some problems in this studio this morning, and I think that they got worked out. Let's try again. Champaign?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. You hear me?
There we go.
Okay. First, the short story, really short. When my children were young, if I sent my daughter for discipline to her room, she'd be hurt, you know. Whereas my son, he would just love it, you know. So you really have to, you know, never felt like striking children. I don't believe in that at all. Anyway, what about the relationship? There was a learning style, and it used to be called something like diverger, converger, assimilator, and accommodator.
Right.
Does that also work in somehow, too?
Yeah, it does. I'm very familiar with that research, and it was extraordinarily well done research, and way ahead of its time, because we began to realize at that time that kids do have individual learning styles. The greatly overused analogy that kids are like snowflakes, but it really is true. As you said, in your own family with two children, they'd respond totally differently to the same discipline technique that you use. And yeah, that does have a lot to do with it. In fact, that work, my understanding, is the work that just referred to in terms of convergent and divergent thinking, kind of fell out of Maslow's work as well. So, it's funny, almost every psychologist in the field has been discredited, Freud and Jung, and, people love discrediting the giants, but people kind of leave Maslow alone because it was just really good, solid stuff that he proved beautifully, and I think he was a good observer of human beings. So that research came from the same research that I was using.
The next one, one thing I discovered, because I taught at the university level, is that I tend to be a diverger, which is great for, creative sessions, because right. You're always going off in directions. The next one is, what about the impact of, was it Gardner, that in terms of different kinds of intelligence?
Right.
To me, that's a motivator, because I've seen, I think there was a thing in Indianapolis or somewhere where there was a school that, that's what they started with. They found out, in other words, if a child really liked music and all that kind of thing,
right?
So they'd start them there to get them, he or she, motivated throughout the day. So is that being applied?
Yeah, it is, and I think the great gift that Howard Gardner brought to the field is that recognition that there are different kinds of intelligence. We, for years, had measured intelligence just in terms of verbal ability, there is an intelligence that Tiger Woods has, that Wayne Gretzky has, that's a different kind of intelligence that might be measured on an intelligence test, and yet it's intelligence that ought to be recognized. And he came up with the various kinds of intelligence that can be used, musical intelligence, artistic intelligence, that we really need to pay attention to. We still have, and I'm a huge believer in cultural literacy and a big believer in liberal arts education, but we still do not allow kids to begin to specialize until they get into college. And, if that a kid is a very talented musician in the third grade, perhaps we ought to back off in the algebra a little bit and give this kid some extra music lessons, because that's probably the way he's going to make his living, or it's certainly the way he's going to enjoy his life. And we don't allow kids to specialize really until they get into college, and in some cases really not until junior or senior in college. Other countries and other cultures really begin to specialize kids a little bit earlier, and I think maybe you ought to take a look at that. And I think that's what Gardner was saying, is let's recognize the hidden talents of these kids rather than trying to cram a liberal arts education down their throats when the die has already been cast in terms of what this kid's real strengths are. Let's work with those.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank
You're
you.
You're very welcome. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, if you'd like to join us with a question, a comment. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. I had a guest on not too long ago, and we talked a little bit about, she too is interested in families, in kids and students. And one of the things that she said that was kind of interesting is we're not allowing our children to discover their hidden talents. We're not allowing them to find them. We're cramming it all in and saying, you got to do this, you got to do that, you got to do this.
Yeah, I think there is there's sort of a salad bar approach to that thing now, where we lay all these possibilities out in front of the kid. I have a concern, too, along those lines, that we tend sometimes to do what I call in the book turning play into work, where the five-year-old girl is watching television with her mom, and there's an advertisement on because the Nutcracker Ballet is going to be in Champaign that weekend, and she says, oh, gee, that looks like fun. Ballet looks like fun. All of a sudden, mom signed her up for 25 ballet lessons a week and, going out and shopping for tutus and costumes. And my thing is, just buy her a used tutu and let her dance around the kitchen. That's what she wants. She doesn't. You don't necessarily want to grab the first interest this kid has and sort of make that be the kid's identity. And I think there's some wonderful work done by a gentleman named David Elkind in The Hurried Child, who says that we're so busy as parents now that we tend to want to specialize our kids. in the sense that our lives are so complicated. It's much easier if you say, I've got three kids. One likes to read, one likes to cook, and one likes to play soccer. And, you know, that way I can get all my work done by making sure I buy a book for the kid who likes to read, the one who likes to cook and help me make spaghetti tonight, and the one who likes soccer, I'll take him to soccer practice. God forbid the soccer player takes up an interest in reading. You know, that messes up the system. And the parents say, no, 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 this is getting too complicated. Put the book down, go play soccer. Because we want to manage our kids well, and because we want to give our kids what they need, there is this tendency to specialize kids and to kind of put them in one little cubbyhole or another. And I think that's being done too early in many cases, and I think it's to the detriment of the kid.
Yeah. Well, earlier you said school is the job. But play is part of school, so play is part of the job as well.
It sure is. And in my first book, It's So Much Work to Be a Friend, what I did is talked about the tremendous number of kids who we have who not only have learning problems, but also have what we call social learning problems, who just are not able to establish and maintain friendships. And you talked earlier about the long-term price that little boy must have faced who broke his glasses every other Thursday. Well, the long-term price of not having friends as a child is extraordinary, mm-hmm. because childhood friendship is a social skills laboratory where you learn social skills. If you went to somebody's house on a rainy Sunday afternoon to play Monopoly, you were playing Monopoly, but you're also learning how to share, how to take turns, how to follow directions, how to give compliments, how to receive compliments. And if you don't have those experiences, you end up as an adult with very poor social skills. So, play is the work of childhood, as Freud said. And if kids don't have an opportunity to play and don't play appropriately and correctly, they end up not learning some skills that they need to use as adults.
Yeah. I mentioned in my introduction the title of one of your videos, Last One Picked, First One Picked, on the social implications of learning disabilities. Are there additional or different challenges in motivating children with learning disabilities?
Yeah, very different. And there are many reasons for it, but probably the primary reason is that many kids with learning disabilities, by the time getting to fifth to sixth grade, they have what my colleague Mel Levine calls chronic success deprivation. I mean, they've just had no success. They don't even know what it's like. They've never experienced any success. And so then in fifth or sixth grade, teachers start saying, if you try harder, you can be successful. And their response kind of is, well, what is this success thing you're talking about? You keep trying to sell it to me, and, you know, give me a taste of it. I don't even know what it's like. And so what I say to teachers and parents is you need to almost invent opportunities for these kids to experience some success if you want to motivate them. Now, I'll say to parents, not too tongue-in-cheek, that if the only thing your 11-year-old kid with a learning disability knows how to do is use a Phillips head screwdriver, if that's the only strength he's got, then every Thursday before he gets off the school bus, Ma, you go around the house and loosen every screw in the house and give him the screwdriver and say, go to a pal, because nobody does it like you. You need to almost come up with opportunities for these kids to experience success, because oftentimes, by the time, as I said, they get into middle childhood and into adolescence, they've had no experience with success at all. So that's the main challenge of kids with learning problems. And the other thing that's outlined in the book is many kids with learning problems have great difficulty with something that doesn't get a lot of attention in our field, even in special ed, and it's known as performance inconsistency, that literally some days they can do it and some days they can't. And it's beyond their control. So, you know, some days they know the five times tables on Tuesday. They don't know them on Wednesday. And you can imagine how frustrating that must be, that you study hard for a test, you know the material on Thursday night, you know it on Friday morning when you get up, then you go into the test on Friday at 10 o'clock and the information's not there. You can't find it. You can't access it. And then at 10 o'clock that night when you're watching television, suddenly the information comes back to you. If that happens to you a lot, you can imagine how difficult it is to stay motivated. So, yeah, there's a big movement in the field called universal design now, where we're beginning to recognize, frankly, that many of the things we've been doing for years in special ed are just really good techniques for all kids. And a lot of most of the strategies that we use that are in the book are really strategies we use with kids with learning disabilities. But guess what? Those strategies will work for your best and brightest kid,
sure,
if he's having a bad day or doesn't understand something.
Sure. There's an example of this would be how you take apart the task of making a bed.
Yeah, exactly. That basically, there's a four-step process to that. That basically, and I use the example of making a bed. If you want to teach a kid something, first of all, you do it for him. let him watch while you do it, and you sort of talk him through it and say, this is what I'm going to do now. This is the next step. After doing that a few times, you do it with him, where he sort of helps you with the various process, the various steps. And then the third step is to have him do it and watch him while he do it, and watch him while he does it, and observe him and say, okay, now you've got to do this section and this section, but he's actually doing it on his own. And then the last step, of course, is to have him do it. It's a fairly simple sort of a learning theory that you can, and I think I say in the book, I've taught kids how to shoot bow and arrow this way, I've taught kids how to make beds, I've taught kids pretty much anything using that very, very simple technique. And it takes a little bit of time, but your option, I guess, Ma, is to make the bed for the kid until he's 21, and you don't want to do that either. So it's a neat little, not terribly scientific, frankly, but a very effective little learning theory that you can use with kids to help them get things done.
Yeah. Or with anybody.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. I've had people tell me that they use that approach in the workplace when they're training new employees.
Yeah,
it just makes sense.
Yeah, I would think in that way your employee, you know, you've got a big investment here. That way that employee really learns it and's got it down. And there's no pressure for the employee to say, yeah, right, got it.
Right, exactly. You really hit on something there, Celeste, because as I said, I've been doing this workshop for 10 years. I cannot tell you the number of times that I've gotten emails or people have come up and said, you know, I came to this workshop to learn how to motivate my kid, but this makes sense. I'm going to use this at work. I'm going to use this approach at work. That, again, not all the employees are going to be motivated by having their picture put up on the bulletin board. You've got to find different ways to motivate different employees. And motivation is the only construct in psychology that is the same through the entire lifespan. I'm motivated, as I said, by affiliation. I'm 57 years old. I'm very motivated by affiliation. When I was a kid, I was motivated by affiliation. I was motivated by autonomy. Now, I was motivated by autonomy as a kid. It's one of the few psychological constructs that is constant through your life.
Yeah, that was interesting. I'll be in the library while you guys have the pep rally.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And yet we think that, you know, who wouldn't want to go to the pep rally? Let's reward everybody by going to the pep rally. And you got 25 or 30% of the kids who are sitting there who would rather be almost anywhere else.
Right. Well, in school, it's not so bad, you know, for the sports teams. But workplace pep rally is about the grimmest kind of thing. There's a chapter in the book explaining learning disabilities to your child.
Yep.
And you do so much work on issues surrounding learning disabilities. What advice can you share with us about how to talk with a child about his or her disability? What might a child with a learning disability want to know?
Well, first of all, he wants you to identify it. The thing is, I've had parents say to me, Celeste, I don't want him to know. I don't want him to talk about it. Well, if you don't tell him what his problem is, you've left him no choice but to believe what the other kids tell him his problem is, which is that he's a dummy and he's stupid and none of those things are true. So it's always been a puzzlement to me that if your child had diabetes, the first thing you would do is explain to the child, this is what diabetes is, this is how your body works, this is what you can eat, this is what you need to avoid. And yet when the kid has learning disabilities, parents are reluctant to talk to them about it. And they need that information as well, because as I said, if you don't tell them the real scoop, they're going to believe what they hear from the other kids. It needs to be done in a gentle way, a little bit at a time. I draw the analogy that talking to kids about learning disabilities, about racism, about sexism, about sex, about any of those important topics, what we tend to do as parents is we want to have one talk to them about it once, and then never bring it up again. And it's not the way kids learn those kinds of things. I draw the analogy that the parent is a pitcher, a water pitcher filled with information about learning disabilities that you want the kid to have. But the kid is a water glass, and so you pour a little bit in till the glass is full, then you put the pitcher down. And you wait till you can pour more in. You don't just dump the whole pitcher into the glass. It's not going to work that way. And I think it needs to be, you know, explaining to the kid in a gradual way, in vocabulary the kid can understand based on his developmental level. But I do strongly encourage parents that they talk to their kids about the disabilities and the problems that they have.
Yeah. One last question here.
Sure.
And we got to wrap up. What does a classroom look and feel like where the kids and the teacher are working together as a motivated team?
Well, it's really a culture. It's the work on classroom culture has been done for years. It's a culture where everyone feels safe, everyone feels accepted, everyone feels successful. If you can get an environment where every kid feels safe, that no kid is afraid that if he says the wrong answer, he's going to be humiliated by the other kids, or worse yet, humiliated by the other, by the teacher, where a kid feels safe to volunteer answers, feels safe that he'll be accepted, that's a good school, a good classroom environment, and where each kid is successful. Where each kid leaves the end of the, leaves class at the end of the day feeling that he's accomplished something, feeling that good things are happening, and there are people in that classroom who care about him. It's as simple and as complex as that. I mean, it's a, that sounds very simple, but it's not easy to establish that kind of environment because kids do tend to bully each other and that kind of thing. But it really is up to the adult in the room to say, this is something, as Winston Churchill said, this is something up with which we will not put, you know. And we really need to give the kids, particularly the struggling kids, the support that they need.
Yeah. So they'll be happy to show up the next day.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. And I in the book, there's a whole section on how much we can learn from coaches, you know, that a good coach makes sure that he begins every practice with something the kids know how to do and ends the practice with something the kids know how to do. So they come into practice all excited and they leave practice all excited. That's a coaching technique that's been used for years. It's a great teaching technique as well.
Mm. Richard Lavoie, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it's my great pleasure, and let's do it again sometime.
Okay, great. Richard Lavoie, he is the author most recently of The Motivation Breakthrough, Six Secrets to Turning on the Tuned Out Child. He's also the author of It's So Much Work to Be Your Friend, Helping the Child with Learning Disabilities Find Social Success.